You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For the second year in a row, the U.S. Supreme Court has reversed decades of legal precedent with impacts that could last generations. In a 6-3 ruling, the High Court effectively ended affirmative action nationwide. By declaring race can no longer be a factor in the admissions process, the ruling forces colleges and universities to find other ways to cultivate a diverse student body. That's something that California public universities have been attempting for decades. In 1996, California voters banned race-based admissions at public universities. The University of California actually filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court supporting affirmative action, saying that despite more than 25 years of finding alternatives, campuses still struggle to enroll a diverse student body. But there are success stories, and we don't have to travel that far. UC Davis has one of the most diverse medical school programs in the country without affirmative action. So we're going to start our conversation here. Joining us is Dr. Mark Henderson, Associate Dean for Admissions at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Vicky.
Dr. Henderson, you have a unique perspective of what's to come for colleges and universities across the country following the Supreme Court decision. Having navigated the admissions process yourself, how do you think this ruling will shape future student bodies?
Well, I think if we use California as an example, as you mentioned, in 1996, when affirmative action was banned here, the diversity of the public schools such as UC Berkeley and UCLA really suffered, particularly with respect to the Latino and African-American student population. So many would predict the same thing going forward in other parts of the U.S., including medical schools, unless they take major steps to, I suppose, prevent that decline.
Within higher education, how has the diversity of medical schools evolved over the years and decades?
Well, I think in California, again, we've, since I've been in this position as Associate Dean for Admissions, we've been able to operate in this environment, if you will, an anti-affirmative action environment. And really, we've done it through a host of measures. I think we use a very broad and multi-pronged process that includes a holistic assessment of every applicant's potential to help meet workforce needs in California. As a public school, UC Davis is one that aims to train physicians who will help address our state's diverse healthcare needs, and particularly for communities that have difficulty accessing medical care, such as rural Californians. So sticking to that mission, I think, has been a key part of our success and other schools' success.
Yeah, and you have had some success as well. What have been some of the important learning lessons that you and your colleagues have learned in pursuit of having a student body that's reflective of the state demographics?
Yes, I think principally by including individuals from communities that have struggled with healthcare or in many ways been left out of healthcare, they bring a lived experience and a deep understanding of the barriers that are experienced by many of our patients, honestly. And when you have that lived experience, when you have that understanding, I think it's easier for you to both relate to many patients, patients from all walks of life, as well as to earn their trust when you ask them to take a medication or to undergo a procedure that you think they need. You know, there's, you know, I think a lot of times people think what you do as a physician is know a lot. And certainly that's important. You have to know a lot, but you also have to be able to earn the trust of your patients in almost any part of medicine. Otherwise, they won't be able to move forward with the treatment plan that you've developed.
Yeah. When you talk about having a holistic approach to the admissions process, I mean, that sounds very nuanced and it depends on each individual with their unique lived experiences and circumstances. One tool that your medical school uses is an adversity score. How does that work?
Sure. Well, to be clear, it's not really an adversity score as many have described. What the Davis scale is really just a small part of that process that I alluded to earlier, where we try to assess each candidate's potential to help meet the workforce needs. It uses basically a number of socioeconomic variables that are contained in every medical school application. And it's basically an estimate of the rough estimate of the barriers encountered by an individual applicant, whether they be economic or educational, such as, let's say, having to work your way through college. And we believe that the ability to overcome such obstacles is a reflection of grit, resilience, commitment, as well, again, as the ability to connect and establish trust with patients from all walks of life. These qualities, while not talked about, I think are super important for physicians in California and frankly anywhere. Again, a tool is just one part of our much bigger process that includes grades, test scores, and the usual things that you might think about, healthcare experience, et cetera.
Hmm. How does taking that into account, the way that UC Davis does, how does it differ from other medical schools' admissions processes?
Well, I think every medical school, the Association of American Medical Colleges compels us to consider our mission when we develop an admissions process and to make our processes and practices concordant with that mission. So for us, it's relatively easy to focus on health equity and health disparities, again, trying to reach out to and represent historically marginalized or excluded communities so that we can improve care for all Californians. I think the way our process differs, I'm not sure, you know, the process across the country is quite variable. I will say our outcomes differ principally in that we have many, many students from low-income families. That is something that's very different for medical education in this country.
And I would imagine it was different when you went to medical school.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, I, as someone who worked throughout college and in part during medical school as well, I think that, those kinds of experiences, again, helped me relate to patients. And that those kinds of things were very, very helpful when I became a primary care physician, again, because you have to be able to relate to patients. They have to be able to relate to you if you want them to follow your advice. But again, I think most medical students, if you will, come from maybe the more upper income categories is generally, if you look at the distribution of, let's say, economic representation in medical schools, it's not very broad.
Given that UC Davis Medical School has become among the most diverse in the country, I mean, you have, I believe, over 40% of your recent class are first-generation college students. Are other colleges and universities reaching out to you, especially following the Supreme Court ruling about, you know, what they can learn for you from your school and as potentially even a framework to apply to their admissions process?
Yes, I mean, I think we've had inquiries from dozens of medical schools in the past few weeks, and we are trying to do as much as we can to share. You know, again, I'd say going back to the mission, the reason you exist as a medical school is very, very important, and to sort of redouble your efforts. You know, medicine is a public good. As you know, a large parts of the medical education system are financed by public tax dollars. The trust fund, the Medicare trust fund finances huge portions of medical education. So we as medical schools, I think, have a duty to produce a workforce that helps solve some of the healthcare needs of our regions, of our states, of the nation.
Hmm. You know, there is some potential criticism. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, he warned that using proxies for race-like socioeconomic rankings, they could also potentially face legal challenges. Do you think this could impact your medical school?
Well, I mean, I think legal challenges are always out there. As I said, as a public school with a mission to serve California and really to produce physicians for all Californians, we feel strongly we're doing the right thing. And so sometimes, you know, you have to just proceed and let the chips fall where they may. I think critics may erroneously assume we admit students who are somehow less than because they come from more humble backgrounds. I would assert that these individuals actually bring more to the table, both clinically and in a research setting. Their lived experience is value added. Their passion for improving healthcare for all is critical to achieving health equity in this country. So I'm not that worried.
Hmm. Yeah, ahead of the Supreme Court decision in June, the American Medical Association, they met in Chicago, and they adopted a new policy that opposes the use of legacy status, and that's essentially preference based on family or alumni, as a tool for screening medical school applicants. Do you think that this is an important step in the right direction, ensuring a medical workforce is reflective of the populations that they serve?
Well, yes, the AMA is concerned that the current physician workforce is not representative of the broader society or nation. And I happen to agree. And really, it's not just my opinion. If you look at it, legacy applicants come from a very narrow segment of society. And for the reasons I've already stated, that is health inequities, we're actually trying to broaden representation, not narrow it. Again, make it more like society at large.
Finally, Dr. Henderson, if someone is interested in applying to medical school, maybe at UC Davis, but, you know, given that you have a lot of first-generation college students, what would you like them to know if they feel intimidated or they don't know if it's possible?
Well, I'd say, first of all, medicine is hard. It's a wonderful career, but it's much more like a marathon than a sprint, as the saying goes. Most of our students at UC Davis have actually had a few years of life or healthcare experience prior to applying to medical school, which we believe adds to their potential as future physicians. So I guess my advice would simply be, make sure you're up for the duration of the race and in the process, as much as, I mean, be yourself and try to highlight the experiences that you bring to the table that will improve the care of your future patients. Mm.
Dr. Mark Henderson is an associate dean for admissions at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Vicki.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're discussing the Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action, effectively banning race from being taken into account during the college admissions process. We're going to continue the conversation by speaking with Lance Izumi, Senior Director of Education Studies at the Pacific Research Institute, to learn why he supports the Supreme Court's decision. Welcome, Lance.
Well, thank you very much, Vicki. I appreciate your invitation to be on your show today.
Yep. Thank you for making the time. So you have described this decision as a step in the right direction. In your view, what is the right direction?
Well, I think that, the Supreme Court based its decision on the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and specifically the Equal Protection Clause. And that means that every American in this country, regardless of the race that they happen to belong to or that they claim, is entitled to an equal application of the laws in their situation, and that you cannot use race to disadvantage that person, because in doing so, what you do is you actually violate this constitutional provision that they are entitled to the equal application of American law. And I think that what the Supreme Court did in this decision was to ensure that ideal that has always been enunciated by this court, but which has along the way, become unfortunately encrusted with some exceptions to that rule, that the court finally decided, and they said this in their decision, that eliminating discrimination means eliminating it all. And I think that that's what this court did. And I think, specifically what they did in regards to, because the plaintiffs is in the Harvard case were Asian American applicants. And so these applicants, unfortunately, for many of them, were treated in an unequal fashion, and that, they had a much lower chance of getting into Harvard despite their academic credentials. And so therefore, the Supreme Court found that there was an unequal application of the laws based upon the 14th Amendment to these Asian American applicants. And that's why they eventually decided in this case to strike down race preferences in college admissions. Mm.
But there are also, on the flip side, there are a number of Asian American groups that have spoken out against the court's decision. You know, they claim affirmative action has played a beneficial role in ensuring a pathway to higher education for many people in their community. And these groups also pointed out that there weren't really any Asian American students who physically stepped forward in the lawsuit to say that they've been discriminated against. So do you think politics played a role, you know, in why this lawsuit was brought about?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, there's politics always, you know, in you know, any kind of public policy that you're trying to change. But I will say that, you know, and those Asian groups that, you know, oppose this decision, obviously they're free to have their view on this. But I do think that if you talk to the average Asian American parent and student who is trying to go through this college admissions process, they really worry a lot about, you know, how their race is going to affect them. And so, I mean, it's common knowledge within the Asian community, for example, that when you're applying for college and they get this advice, oftentimes from advisors, college advisors that, you know, will tell them, if you're Asian, don't make a big thing of that in your college essay application, or don't include a photograph of yourself, because that may end up being a negative mark against you in the college admissions process. So, you know, again, regardless of what these other groups may say, if you look again at, you know, what the average American, Asian American family is dealing with, that's what they're dealing with. And that's the worry that has always been there for many years.
When we're talking about Asian American, that's such a broad term, right? There's so many countries that fit and cultures that fit into Asian American. What are you talking specifically about, certain countries and certain cultures, or just all of them?
No, that is a really important point, Vicky. And I think the reason that's so important is because Chief Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion in this case, underscored the fact that the problem with using the category Asians is that it is so over-inclusive of people. And so therefore you have, he pointed out that you have people from South Asia, let's say Indians or Pakistanis, to people from Far East Asia, like Japan and China. You know, I'm Japanese American. But all these different cultures in Asia are very different from each other. There is no one quote unquote Asian culture. So when we talk about diversity, and those who are unhappy with this decision will say, well, this decision will impact diversity on campuses. Well, you know, you have to look at what the category of Asians means. Asia encompasses about 60% of the world's population. And you have, you know, people who are Muslims, you have people who are Christians, you have people who are Buddhists and Hindus. You have this incredible cross-section of world population in Asia, and it's incredibly diverse. And so when you just say that, you know, talk about Asians, I think that people may have the stereotype, and this is one of the things that the court hammered on, is the fact that we cannot allow the use of a term like Asians to end up as a stereotype for that group.
So given that we actually can look to California and see how this has played out, how have you come to understand the fact that the University of California, when they filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court supporting affirmative action, the chancellors at these campuses said that despite more than 25 years of trying to find alternatives, campuses still struggle to enroll a diverse student body, especially more elite universities within the U.S. UC system like UCLA and Berkeley?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things, Vicky. I mean, first of all, I think it's ironic that, you know, the UC folks would do that in a state where the voters have overwhelmingly voted in favor of race-neutral college admissions.
It was 55%.
55%. Yes. But then when the effort to overturn it was made a year or two ago, it was a 57% majority that voted against the effort to overturn Prop 209. So, you know, so a lot of Californians, you know, want to have a race neutral college admission system. And I think that, though, that, you know, one of the problems with focusing on this issue of college admissions solely is that it overlooks the fact that the universities are suffering from a very difficult pipeline from the K-12 system. And if you look, for example, at what the UC Academic Senate in a 2020 study that they put out, they found that the reason why there is such a difficulty in increasing the number of underrepresented minorities in the UC system is because the K-12 pipeline is not providing them with the students that would take the A through G college preparatory courses that would make them eligible for UC enrollment. And the chancellor at that time, Janet Napolitano, also confirmed that the real problem is the lack of underrepresented minorities taking the A through G courses. And so if we really want to improve the numbers of underrepresented minorities in the UC system, which I think everybody would love to see that, it's to increase the pool of students who are eligible to come in. And so it doesn't help to have high income underrepresented minority students only at UC. A lot of those students who are not being able to apply even to UC are underrepresented minorities from very poor areas. And so therefore, I think that we need to ensure that those kids are getting that type of education that would make them eligible for UC enrollment, at the end of their K-12 career.
Given that K-12 public schools, especially in underrepresented communities, I mean, they arguably bear the most responsibility, as you say, you say that they bear the most responsibility, but also they're facing a lot of serious challenges when it comes to staffing and funding and just overall resources for these students. What are some solutions in the interim, to help the public school system to make sure that the applicant pool is reflective?
Well, I think that one of the things that they could do right off the bat is look at other states that have been able to really turn around the performance of those kids who are in at-risk categories, who are in underrepresented categories. I mean, all of us here in California, we always like to laugh at Mississippi as being always at the end of the education train. But Mississippi, if you look at what they did in the mid-2010s, they totally changed the way they implemented reading instruction in the classroom. And so they went from whatever they were doing before to a very scientific, research-based reading instructional program that emphasized phonics, for example. But what they did, what the impact of this was that Mississippi went amongst its low-income students. Those kids who, I'm sure California would love to have in the UC system, they went from amongst the worst performing reading scores in the country to, by 2022, second in the country in just a really short period of time. And so it wasn't necessarily that Mississippi decided to spend a boatload of money. What they decided to do was to change their educational program to reflect what really works in the classroom. And it had a huge impact on the students there. And what that does for Mississippi is that it increases the pool of those kids who are now going to be eligible probably for higher education institutions in Mississippi and out of state. So I think that's something that we can do, especially when you look at the fact that here in California, our reading scores, our math scores, those core basic subjects, that there is overwhelming lack of proficiency among students in K-12 in these underrepresented minority communities.
We have about 20 seconds left. I'm just curious if in the coming years, if diversity drops at colleges and universities across the country, how will you square that? Is that an outcome in line with this decision?
Well, again, I think that what this decision does is it puts pressure on all kinds of different players to not allow that to happen. So that, Professor Henderson was talking about ways that they're increasing enrollment amongst underrepresented minorities using race neutral ways. And I think that that's what these universities have to do. But the most important thing is that they need to improve the eligibility pool of kids from those underrepresented minority groups.
Lance, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Vicky. I appreciate the invitation.
Lance Izumi is a Senior Director of Education Studies at the Pacific Research Institute. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.